Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith, and hope. Discover more interviews at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Hi, this is Stephen O'Doherty. In a civil society, do I have the right to insult you? And should you have the right to seek remedy from a tribunal or a court? There's a lot of airtime given to that issue, and no wonder. Social media platforms now give us wide and fast dissemination of unfettered views, whether it's erudite analysis or just thought bubbles of hate. But what is it to be a civil society? What are our rights and responsibilities? Mark Sneddon is a barrister, and he's worked as a senior legal advisor to both Labor and Conservative governments in Victoria. His conviction is that we need to be careful not to lose the old notion of checks and balances. And he set up a new think tank called the Institute for Civil Society. So let's go right to the core of it. Do we have the right, morally or legally, to preach hatred or to speak out, you know, to speak hate speech in this country? And should we have such a right?
I think I answer that by saying that we have morally and legally a right of free speech or free expression. And that's something that's come down to us through the common law and through generations of people fighting for that right. So it's a very precious right. Then the question arises, how do we exercise that right? And I think we have a moral and a social responsibility to exercise that right in a responsible manner, which would include not inciting hatred against other people. But I think where your question's going is, how do we appropriately put limits or sanctions on misuses of our right of free speech?
Mm. Because you get the impression, and certainly some of the social media comments and so on around this 18C issue during the week has been about, look, if I want to offend you, then I just have every right to do so, and I, you know, there should be no limitations on what I say. Now, there may be no legal limitations, but I rather start to think, why should we have a society where we actually set about creating freedoms for ourselves to deliberately insult, vilify, incite hatred?
I think I'd start somewhere away from there and come and work back to that. So why do we have a right to free speech? We have a right to free speech because we're looking for truth. And in the theory of the marketplace of ideas, the more different views we have out there, the more likely we are to test them. And what is true or what works for society will change over time. So we need to keep constantly engaging in that process. Secondly, we realise that one person's truth is another person's question, is another person's falsehood. And we need the ability to be able to debate those things. Mm. So the right of free speech is very important to be testing and counter-testing, because we change our mind and we change our views. And we also, as a society, we need to learn to live together. And we have to keep constantly learning that, because our society keeps changing. And if we can't communicate freely and responsibly with each other, we won't be able to live together. We'll end up in our own little silos throwing bricks at each other.
Much of the discussion has been around whether the law is culture shaping or whether it represents more of a handbrake. So, you know, I mean, isn't there a view that the law should step in if all other forms of self-protection or self-limitation have failed? That we shouldn't actually use the law to try to limit someone's ability to speak, but use it rightly in the cases where someone has legitimately been injured?
Yes, we have a social and a cultural and a moral freedom of speech, and we have a legal right to freedom of speech as well. I think the primary sanction for irresponsible use of freedom of speech should be social and cultural. That is to say, it should be discussed in pubs, clubs, dinner tables, shopping centres, the media and social media, whether what was said was reasonable, balanced, hateful, not hateful, etc. So that, in other words, the remedy for bad speech is good speech and the formation of a social consensus that was beyond the pale.
Yeah, in other words, people come up to you in the street or they get onto Facebook and they say, hey mate, that's a bit dopey.
Yeah, pull your head in.
Yeah, pull your head in, don't agree with you. Yep.
Correct. Now, there are some cases, and we have them in the law, where in addition to those social breaks or social sanctions on misuse of free speech, to protect specific interests which are important in our society, we have some legal limitations on free speech. So the law of defamation is a limitation on free speech to protect against damage to the reputation of a particular person. So if I use my free speech right to damage the reputation of another person and pull them down in the estimation of other people, they may have a legal right to sue me for damages and compensation. Understand that. That's protecting a specific economic and personal interest of the other person.
Okay, I think that's pretty that's pretty well made and very clear to most people. You then enter the area of great difficulty where these where things just mash up to the point where they become indistinguishable. Human rights law. So you're balancing my right against your right.
Yes.
Is there a balance of rights? Do I have the right to be a bigot, for instance? Do I have the right to say that I'll only employ men in an occupation that clearly could also be for women? No, that's a transgression of the rights of those women. How does the law, how does society balance those two things? Much harder than a simple defamation case.
It is a lot harder than a simple defamation. But I think the instance of defamation gives us an example of that. We're trying to balance two rights there. One is the right to free speech, and the other is the person's right to have their reputation maintained and upheld in the community.
Hmm.
So you have to identify what are the respective rights at stake and then do some sort of a balancing between them. And it's exactly the same thing when we get to a competition between human rights in particular instances. We have to say, all right, what are the relevant rights that are being implicated here? Are we at the core of those rights? Are we really damaging the human right here? And which are the human rights that are really being damaged? And what's the balance on the other side? What's the goal we're trying to achieve? And are we doing it proportionately and reasonably? And you weigh those things up.
Now, I had a discussion with Tim Wilson, who I find a very clear thinker on this issue. He was one of the guys featured in the Coopers video, but he was the Human Rights Commissioner. And he takes the view, and I would agree with him, that religious freedom is actually a higher level of right, if you like, a higher level of human right than many of the other lesser rights, which means that in the question, say, of employment policy for churches, do churches and church organisations like Christian schools, for instance, do they have the right to exercise their religion in a way that says we want Christians to be able to teach in this school because we are a Christian community? Now, that's protected in anti-discrimination acts around the country, but it's not actually regarded as a fundamental human right in some jurisdictions, in some states or territories. And some are arguing that maybe it should be.
The right to freedom of religion is a freestanding right, independent of any question of discrimination on the grounds of religion.
It derives from where?
It derives from the experience in England, and in terms of our culture, of the religion wars, where one side would get on top and then persecute the other, and another side would get on top and persecute the others, and then some they'd persecute minority sects. And after a while, everyone thought, when people had fled to the United States and they passed religious tolerance laws there, that this was just a completely unacceptable way to carry on. And it was foundational to the having a civil society that people should be able to adopt and change, express and manifest their religious beliefs with freedom, without being oppressed by the state and without being denied the right to worship or manifest their
beliefs. So even if we don't have a law that says that, a piece of legislation, the common law and tort law, law enacted by the courts will recognise that as a human right, will they?
In my view, yes. I think it's as fundamental a right as the right of freedom of expression or freedom of association.
Yeah.
I think not every commentator says that, but I think it is part of the common law. In any event, it is certainly a part of all the foundational international human rights documents. It's in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the UN. It's in the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights. And there are specific rights about declaration of the rights to freedom of religion and religious belief.
And where do I go for a remedy?
For a remedy, you would go to a court, but then you'd have to find a legal basis for that. Now, the difficulty we have with common law, well, it's not a difficulty, it's just judge-made law can always be overridden by parliament-made law, a statute.
And that's like that's one of the essential arm wrestles of a country like ours, which, and we describe our system as the rule of law,
yep.
But the arm wrestle between the legislature, the parliaments, the lawmakers, and the judges, the law interpreters, that's actually that's quite an essential arm wrestle, isn't it?
Yes, it is an essential arm wrestle. I suppose I was just doing some basic civics there, which is to say, if you're right that you're aggrieved about, it's been taken away by a statute, but common law isn't going to be sufficiently powerful to help you.
Good.
So what you need is an appeal to the proper interpretation of that statute, which might be interpreted against the background of the common law protection of the right to religious freedom, or whatever the right is.
Well, this is helpful because it takes us right to the heart of this week's debate about 18C.
Yep.
You've got a law in the federal parliament that uses words like insult and offend.
Mm-hmm.
This is the parliament trying to impose a set of values on the courts.
Oh, well, on society, I think.
On society, for the courts to use when people go for remedy.
Yes.
And so judges have interpreted that. And so, too, have tribunals, for instance, the Human Rights Tribunal itself. It may yet be that the way in which they have used that in some well-known cases, like Bill Leak, like the students in Queensland, maybe that's actually the real problem rather than what the legislation said. But what do you make, then, of the Prime Minister's decision, the Liberal Party's decision, to change all of those words and insert instead the word harass? Harass and intimidate?
Harass and intimidate, I think so. Well, at the Institute for Civil Society, we would support the proposed amendment, which is to remove the words offend and insult and even humiliate from the section. So currently the section says it's unlawful for a person to do an act otherwise than in private if the act is reasonably likely in all the circumstances to offend, insult, humiliate or intimidate another person or a group of people and the act's done because of their race.
Just in passing, this means that if I'm having a conversation with my mate over coffee or down at the pub or something, you know, I'm not going to fall foul of that law. A private conversation is not included.
That's correct. It has to be otherwise than in private. You're quite right.
But if we're in a restaurant and we point to someone at the next table and say, you're a so-and-so, you know, whatever, based on race, religion and these other characteristics, then that is a different matter.
Absolutely.
All right. So now you're explaining the change. Go ahead. Sorry, keep going on that journey. Sorry to interrupt.
The difficulty with the current wording, I think, is it sets the bar too low for a legal sanction.
Right.
So, and where I think it sets the bar too low is in using the words offend and insult. So if the act is reasonably likely in all the circumstances to offend or insult another person and the expression or act is done because of race or colour, then you are subject to legal sanction, ultimately may have to pay damages.
By the way, religion is not covered in 18C.
Oh, no, just race.
Yeah.
Or as was mentioned in the paper recently, there is a proposal being mooted perhaps within the ALP to extend the grounds on which 18C might apply, but we might come to that later.
Yeah.
So currently it's offend, insult, humiliate or intimidate. But the problem is this. If my right of free speech or your right of free speech stops at the point where someone else may be reasonably offended by what you say, then that's a very low bar for stopping your right of free speech.
Yeah.
I understand about inciting violence. I understand about intimidating even another person. But to say I can be pulled up for legal sanction simply because what I say might be reasonably taken as offending another person on the ground of race is, I think, too low a bar. And the same with insult. And we've seen that, I think, with the QUT case and even the Bill Leak case. Sometimes these things are offensive, sometimes they are insult. I'm not saying that feelings aren't hurt, I understand that, but what I am saying is that the remedy for that is the social and cultural sanction. It shouldn't be a legal remedy. We don't need the law to come in, we don't need the human rights apparatus, we don't need the courts apparatus to come in and say, you're offending someone, and here's a bill for damages. I think those offend and insult should be dealt with by social sanctions.
All right, that case is made. We replace those words with harass and intimidate. How are the courts going to interpret that? Does that give us a better balance? Some people have said, and I think I might almost agree with them, harass seems such a nebulous term, such a strange term.
Yes, I think that there is legal, there's lots of legal meaning around the words harass in other contexts, but it would fall to the courts to interpret it in this particular context.
Is harass a single instance? Is it multiple instances?
I think it's probably multiple instances, but I think it remains for a court to interpret that, and perhaps that's something the Parliament could consider when it puts these amendments in the explanatory memorandum or a definition section to indicate that. Look, I think on a normal meaning you'd think harass would be some intentional course of conduct which is going to cause, you know, mental distress, targeted mental distress against people. So I'm coming at you and I'm coming at you and I'm coming at you to cause you mental distress, or even... You know, inciting people will cause you mental distress. That sort of thing would be what I would consider harassment. But as I say, it depends on if there's any definition in the Act and what the courts do with it. I think my main point is not to defend harass or to explain to you what it means, because I think that's a decision yet to be had. My main point is that offend and insult should come out because they are too low a bar.
We'll be talking about this for many years to come. But the broader question I would think is, I'd say to you, the head of the newly formed Institute for Civil Society, isn't it going to be better if we can build a society not only based on the idea that we don't offend, harass, incite, vilify, where nonetheless we have the right to reasonable discussion and important disagreement, civil disagreement about values and beliefs and all of the great things that make Australia a great democracy. Isn't that where we should be headed?
Yes, that is exactly where we should be headed. And what we need is better examples from our community leaders and our politicians and our media and our other institutions of how to conduct a civil debate and a civil disagreement with one another, where I sit down and I listen to your point of view and I deal and I respond to you. I defend your right to disagree with me. You defend my right to disagree with you. We listen to each other to the maximum extent possible. We agree where we can, and then we try to find a way of living with our disagreements. Q&A is not a good example of how to do this. We need better things than Q&A.
Having lived through that experience, it's so much fun. But
I'm not saying it's not great TV and entertainment.
Well, I don't know that it is anymore. It's very interesting. It's become a very shouty program. And all of the social media around it has been shouty.
Exactly. So we end up with shouties and we end up with bricks in the form of tweets.
And shoes being thrown.
And so we go into our bunkers and we throw shoes or tweets or bricks at one another. And that is destructive of civil society. We need alternative... And people, that's always happened. It will always continue to happen. What we need is a better model that says this is a better way to debate. This is a better way to conduct a discussion in a civil society, a pluralistic democracy where we will have different views, multi-faith, multi-racial, many different views, where we have to negotiate those views.
So now, Mark, I'm going to ask you this question, which is a feature of Open House. Where do you look if you were to find hope for our society?
I would look for the rise of more moderate political leaders and community leaders who will hold debates and engage those who disagree with them with civility and respect. For example, invite their opponents into the tent and say, come and have a discussion with me. And let's do it in public, but here are the ground rules. We don't have a slanted audience. We don't have slanted questions. We don't have a Twitter feed. Let's just have a respectful discussion with one another. Let's have follow-up questions to make sure we get to the end of it. And let me have to tackle your best argument. And you have to tackle my best argument, not some straw man that we throw up, which we knock down and then say, well, okay, they had nothing, so you can ignore them from now on. Where is that going to come from? Might come from the churches. I mean, in Melbourne, Archbishop Freer runs public conversations on issues. I hope it comes from the Institute for Civil Society. I hope as we go on, we actually manage to host some real video debates with opponents, speaking respectfully to one another and put them on YouTube. But, other groups can do that. That would be the way to go. I hope that Malcolm Turnbull and Bill Shorten and our political leaders at state and territory level can do this, that they live in a highly adversarial system, but surely they can rise above that on occasion to have some civil debates with people. I think people like Tim Wilson, model that quite well, that they can sit down and have a reasonable debate. And I thought that I'll probably get into trouble for saying this, but I thought that Bible Society video was actually a good example of how to have a civil debate about same-sex marriage. I mean, it was only a short thing, but you had two people who disagreed with each other speaking respectfully, and they were asked to state what was each other's best argument. And they did that, and they wrapped up the debate. And at the end of that, what you had was a public presentation of both sides of a controversial issue with no one throwing a brick, none of the participants throwing a brick at each other, and just a civil discussion and laying out of views. Now, the response to that was appalling. The response of some sections which in this case the gay lobby were the ones that were offended, and I should be very careful to say it was only a certain section of the gay lobby was offended, came out and said, well, we're going to find whoever's been associated with this, Coopers, how can we get them, we'll boycott them.
And what a shame Coopers actually gave in my view.
It was a shame that they gave in. I mean, Christine Keneally had a very good tweet, the former Labor leader in New South Wales. He said, we've got a great video up on YouTube where Tim Wilson gets to give a reasoned defence of same-sex marriage. What's the problem?
Well, according to one of my interlocutors on Facebook in a discussion forum I became part of, for some in the gay lobby, apparently the problem was that he's a Liberal and the Liberal Party doesn't have a pro same-sex marriage policy. Therefore, they write off Tim Wilson, whereas you ought to be saying, OK, look, if you want to have your policy enacted, get people into the party, which is the same thing Christians ought to be saying. Don't just get on Facebook and condemn people for the view or the position they hold or what their association is. That's the very opposite of free speech, very opposite of a civil society. I condemn you simply because of who you are. I'm not going to listen to you.
That's exactly right. So we're back to the problem. The problem is we go into our bunkers and we say, I don't agree with you and I don't even want to hear from you because you have a view that I disagree with.
Yep.
That's not tolerance. Tolerance is, you know, in the words that may have been falsely attributed to Voltaire, but were attributed to him nonetheless. I may not agree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. I may not like what you say. I may not particularly want to hear it, but it might be good for me to actually sit down and listen to some things I disagree with in case I'm wrong.
Exactly. Well, that's a great place to leave the discussion for just now, but I certainly know that we'll be able to speak with you again in the future, and I'd love to do that. Mark, thank you very much for being with us on Open House.
Thank you very much for having me, Stephen. Much appreciated.